Good day, everyone. This is Marge Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, your weekly opportunity to listen in as my guest authors go deeper into the backstory of their literary work. All of my shows are also available on demand at www.voiceofvashon.org, 101.9 FM, KVSH. And now let me welcome this show's guest author, Jonathan Tessini.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So why don't you dive right on in and just introduce yourself, not necessarily the book we're talking about today, but specifically who you are.
I've been a longtime labor and political activist, strategist, consultant for organizations, and as well has made all or part of my living from writing at different times.
So I am super thrilled with this book that you wrote just a few months ago, if I understand. I mean, you really kicked butt on this one, and it is titled The Essential, Bernie Sanders and His Vision for America.
An organizing handbook as much as anything.
An organizing handbook. So I always ask my authors, you know, what's their purpose when they write something? How are they trying to change the world for the better? And you have a very distinct purpose for this book, correct?
For sure. I was convinced from the time that Bernie announced that he was running that the major challenge that he would have is introducing himself in the short amount of time that was left till the election, since he only started running in May, June, that his biggest challenge would be to reach many, many people who didn't even know who he was or only knew him in passing or vaguely had perhaps seen him on a TV show, because he was fairly outspoken and willing to have his views out there on in the traditional media like MSNBC. So my goal with this book was to create a bridge between Bernie and the voters and get me out of the way and essentially lay out his views. So 95% of the book is really Bernie's words. There's very little from me. And it was really about just trying to organize his views into distinct chapters by topic, so that if you're interested in immigration, for example, there's a chapter you can just dive into. Each chapter is very short. It starts a little introduction and then it's all him. And then at the end, there are a few bullet points about what he's actually done or accomplished in that particular area. And you actually don't have to read the whole book. You can read one or two chapters and then move on. You can actually consult it when you're unclear, when you're having an argument.
So this book is perfect for me 5 months ago. At this point, I'm well-versed in Bernie Sanders, but I still have a lot of friends and people I know who will ask a question about something. And I'm like, okay, we're in a coffee shop standing in line and there's only one person in front of us. And there's no way I can thoroughly answer that question in the next, you know, 2.5 minutes. So I did actually mention this book, and a friend of mine who is not a Democrat by history, but was curious and was paying enough attention underneath the lens. I mean, you know, corporate media, you really don't get any valid information there. So this one friend of mine realized that it was worth getting to know Bernie Sanders. And he found your book and wrote to me recently when I was in Canada on a writing retreat and said, okay, you know, I've got a few questions still for Bernie, but in general, what I'm reading in here is different. Different than what he had seen in corporate media and was more exciting than what he had previously thought with regard to this candidate. So he actually, at some point we need to get to it, I said, you know, I'm going to be talking to the author, and if you've got some questions that are unresolved, forward them to me. He did. He sent me three questions. So let's make sure we maybe touch on those later. So just to be clear for everyone, this book, I'm going to flip it open to the back here, is about 160 pages. It's not huge. It's not super small. It's a very easy to carry, throw in your backpack book. And in the front here, you've got 20 different chapters, roughly. And that's not including introduction or the biography. So specifically 20 chapters. And currently, I believe Bernie Sanders' official platform is 13 areas. Has he increased to 14 yet?
I haven't looked on the website today, but, you know, he's got areas that are perhaps broader than my chapter outline.
Mm-hmm.
He includes things under inequality, for example, include things like taxes, and I have a separate chapter just on taxes.
Right.
So I didn't try to mirror exactly his website, and I created this book in some way while he was building the website. So they weren't designed to be exact reflections of each other.
No. In fact, I'm glad that they're not. Like you have 14 and 15 are immigration and civil rights. Obviously, they share a lot of threads. Why don't you tell us really quickly, I believe the first time you met Bernie Sanders, you were interviewing him for Rolling Stone magazine?
Well, no, actually, I wrote for Playboy, but
that's
not the first time I actually met him. I met him many years before because as a union representative, advocate, and particularly someone that did a lot of lobbying in Washington, I would frequently be in Washington to push for workers' issues, legislation, and things like that. And Bernie would be someone, because he was based in the Northeast where I'm based, that we would encounter either in his office or he'd come to speak to our group. So I had met him many years before, again, in passing, not in any detail, but I did spend a big chunk of time about 2.5 years ago, coming up on 3 years, as I interviewed him for Playboy magazine.
Yeah. Okay. So like I wrote my question here. I thought it was Rolling Stones. Okay. So it's Playboy. And I was like, I'm curious what their interest is, because actually both are fairly irreverent. Megs. And I'm like, okay, he's an older guy who works far too hard to do very much partying. So why would Playboy be interested in Bernie Sanders? I mean, what was going on with them wanting to bring him to their audience?
If you're familiar with Playboy magazine's interviews, they're probably the only place in the country, and perhaps actually in the world, where you can, an individual, a high profile person, whether an entertainer or a politician, can speak at length about their views without people getting in the way. So it's basically a Q&A format, and it's 15 to 20,000 words sometimes. Jimmy Carter's been in it, Fidel Castro, a lot of world leaders, including a lot of entertainment people. So it's a quite a well-known and has broken news over the course of, I guess they've been doing these for 30 to 40 years.
Right.
And so they do political people, and they do both progressives, liberals, and conservatives, although it's harder to get the conservatives to be willing to be in Playboy magazine.
Right.
So they have a little harder time.
So Playboy has tried to come up with a blend of the draw to the magazine on a more excitement-based level, and then also offering actually high-class articles.
Yeah, well, we can go into a whole debate about Playboy magazine and its use, high-class, non-class. The point is this, that it's an interview format. It's unlike anything that exists anywhere that I know of.
Uh-huh.
And it's a place, again, where political people with ideas, philosophers, can expound at length. We're interested in it, and we sat down, I did the interview.
So are you, because I'm not well-versed in the world of journalism, to be able to recognize that there would be something unique about an interview. I mean, that's what I do with my authors is, you know, we do an interview, and I may ask questions or whatever, but in general, I want them to go ahead and expound on their thoughts. And so are you saying that usually an article that's in a magazine is like been manipulated by the person who writes it in such a way that the person who was interviewed for the article may not have control over how they're expressed?
Well, manipulated is a strong word. I would say that what happens is that in normal articles, first of all, someone doesn't get to be quoted at length without being cut up or interrupted. And most of the stuff is in the context or put in context or analyzed by the writer. Q&A format is a person asks a question, the question is printed out, and then the interview subject answers, and then that's printed out, and there's a cue, question, answer, back and forth. And some of it's edited down simply for length reasons, because when you spend many, many hours with someone, you can't publish the whole thing, so you have to select, but
right.
Try to be true to the entire interview. And just the difference is the writer doesn't interrupt with analysis and other side issues.
Right. Got it. And I'm going to take this moment to remind our listeners that you're currently tuned in to the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSH. This is Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. My name is March Twisdale, program host and director, and I'm currently speaking with Jonathan Tessini, who has written the book, The Essential, Bernie Sanders and His Vision for America. there's a bunch of stuff flowing through social media that says, here's how Bernie Sanders can pay for these programs. And there, and I, it's like there's already this battle going on of, well, you know, Bernie Sanders is promoting really great programs, but it's going to cost too much. We can't afford it. And then other people are saying, yeah, we can afford it. Here's how. And that seems to be a growing area of concern.
Well, let's just address that directly rather than being too generic. I think that's a fact of life. There's false information out there. That's just the reality we have to deal with as grown-ups, particularly in the internet world where lots of stuff gets thrown around, even not in politics, but just generally. You just have to have some context. And in part, that was what my book was designed to do, which is to help people go and hear from, if you will, the horse's mouth, exactly what his beliefs were over all these years and what his positions were. And I'm also doing this kind of Bernie 101 around the country where I'm talking about things like budget and how much it's going to cost and just trying to straighten things out. But there's no magic to it. I mean, that's just political life where you have to contest with advertising that's false. We know that in terms of commercial products. So this isn't a particularly shocking thing.
Right. So do you have a chapter in the book that specifically deals with that, or was it written before that became a hot topic?
The chapters deal with specific things he talks about, for example, how you can pay for education, how you can pay for why workers' wages have to go up, and how he actually helped pass a big veterans bill that protected veterans.
Right.
But to your specific question, there's people have to use their wisdom, and they have to check multiple sources. I think the question of how to have an informed citizenry has to do with being in organizations, making sure you know who your sources are, understanding why someone might have a bias if they're putting a particular information out there. So one of the things that's been quoted a lot is this $18 trillion number, which the Wall Street Journal put out. So the first thing you have to understand is it is the Wall Street Journal. They have a particular ideological axe to grind. They are going to make things seem a particular way without explaining and giving context. And that number, what that number doesn't tell you is, number one, $18 trillion over 10 years, which over the next 10 years, the gross domestic product will be something like $240 trillion. So when you put that in context, $18 trillion is actually quite a small number. It's about a point and a half percent of the GDP.
Right.
Further, a huge chunk of that, if you accept that number, about $15 trillion of that is healthcare costs. So all the other things that Bernie's talking about, infrastructure, education, is relatively small. The biggest chunk is healthcare costs. And actually, it's not new money. It's money we already spend. And all Bernie's suggesting we do is reallocate the money and actually end up saving money, because under his proposal, he's always been for 10 and 20, actually 20 years, he's been for a single-payer Medicare for all system, which is not Obamacare. It's not the Clinton care. It gets rid of the insurance companies and essentially operates a healthcare system that would be far more efficient and would probably save us trillions of dollars. And that's just based not on ideological beliefs. That's based on fact that if you look at any other country that has adopted a single-payer Medicare for all system, like Canada or Australia, they've all lowered their healthcare costs dramatically.
Right. You know what I find really interesting about that, and I think this could be like a specific example that maybe people could really relate to, is so in 1998, when I was pregnant with my first son, I was in I can't remember which one it was, but it was one of those pregnancy classes. And I was required to go do some research. And one of the things we were supposed to do is go to the hospital that we were planning to give birth in. I had a home birth, but you always have to have a backup hospital set up, right? And you go to that hospital and you find out what their cesarean section rate is. Because if you look from one hospital to the next, even in a similar demographic area, they're going to have different rates. And so at that time, it was 23% of the births at Evergreen Hospital in 1998 were cesarean section. And so then about maybe 5 years ago, I had a friend who was pregnant and going to have a baby soon, and she did the same research. And at that point, I believe the national average in America at that point had reached 30% cesarean section rate. Meanwhile, that movie. There's a couple movies I've seen and some friends I know that actually live in France. The cesarean section rate in France is 2%. So we've got either over 10 years, you know, the women in Washington suddenly went, 7% of them became incapable of giving birth naturally. And the people of America are completely different biologically than the French women because, you know, a 2% versus 30% is a really big difference. Or there's some money involved in the situation. And one of the arguments that's been made to me by friends that live in Europe is that because the people's money, the taxed money, is being spent on the medical system, the government/medical system is incentivized to reduce the cost. And so in France, you know, you have a lot more prenatal care that's free. Everyone gets prenatal care. You don't end up with some, you know, 23-year-old woman who's poor who shows up in the emergency room with no doctor's visits and she's in labor and she ends up being a cesarean section because she doesn't know what to do. She's freaked out and they're like, okay. Or you don't have the money making. So I think you have number two here talks about healthcare, a right for all. But also we have to tie into, and I don't even know if there'd be a specific chapter to it, but what do you do when big business looks at medical care and says, oh, great, I get to make profit here?
Well, part of the problem we have in our healthcare system around profits is because we have the insurance industry and the drug industry operating at 15 to 25% administrative costs because of high CEO salaries. We're not talking about doctors not being able to make a living. We're talking about people basically ripping off consumers because mm-hmm. of high overhead and enormous salaries and CEO salaries. Mm-hmm. And that's why our premiums are very high. And the goal of Medicare to all is to eliminate all that.
Right.
And Medicare is one of the most efficient programs we've ever created. It operates roughly at 2 to 3% administrative cost. Mm-hmm. So you can just do, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a mathematician to understand that if you actually opted for that system, it would be a whole lot more efficient and cheaper than a system that operates at 15 to 20, 25% administrative cost.
Right. And, you know, it is very interesting. I believe arguably America is still the wealthiest country in the world, roughly. And I find it interesting how successful the 1% of the 1%, whatever you want to call them. But there's this massive message of, guess what? We're desperately poor and struggling and we can't really, you know, you need something. Well, we can't help you because we're going to really all get hurt. And, you know, the poor mouthing of the wealthiest country in the world seems to me to be a really great way to convince all the people at the bottom to not ask for anything from the people at the top by just convincing them that there's nothing to actually ask for.
Do you mean, when you say you mean that we just accept what we have now and just settle for that? Is that your point?
Well, I'm trying to figure out what I can say to a person who believes we cannot improve the situation or make things better because we're too poor as a nation to be able to give more to the people.
We're not too poor as a nation, actually. We're the richest country in human history.
I know.
And there's more wealth. Well, but that's about organizing and politics. That's not about the facts of how much money we have. Individuals feel poor because they've been ripped off. So that's about political education. That's what's exciting about Bernie's campaign is it's really about a political revolution, getting people to think differently about politics and mm-hmm. what's possible. So you just have to show people facts, and that takes time. I'm not saying it happens overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And every time Bernie speaks, he's always very clear that don't expect when he wins the presidency for everything to change the next day. It's mm-hmm. going to take 10 years to make these changes. But people have to choose. Do they want to continue the same way, or do they want to actually have political revolution? They can choose. There is a candidate for the status quo. Her name is Hillary Clinton. That's the status quo, and that's a candidate who will do nothing to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
If you want a real political revolution, that's what Bernie's offering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like I'm not a fan person. I've never had like a favorite rock band, or I don't get into fandom, and I'm not a fan. I'm not a Bernie Sanders fan. I can't be labeled that way. What I feel like I am is a person. I feel like Bernie Sanders is at the end of this nearing the end of this really powerful life where he has remained committed to his values and not sold out for 40 years. He's challenging the American people and saying, okay, look, you can sit around and say that you want a democracy and you want a government that works for the people, but that actually means that you have to go be that government working for the people. You have to wake up, pay attention, get engaged. And if you're willing to do that, I will work for you. I will spend the next 8 years not retiring and hanging out with my grandkids and luxuriating, you know, in a seat on my back porch. I will continue to work and give of my life to you, but it's up to, you know, I mean, if he gets in, my impression is if he gets into the Oval Office, that will happen only because so many people are involved that once he's there, we will stay involved. And that continued involvement over the next 4 to 8 years is what will give him the boost power he needs to then go ahead and successfully advocate on our behalf.
Yes, I think that he, and it's sort of to emphasize that what he said is that the only way this happens is if people stay engaged and engaged in a way that's active at the community level, electoral level, to push the things that we all support. It's not going to happen just because you elect him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been very clear about that. And it's one of the things that's exciting to me is that I see that he understands that this is going to be something that's going to take a lot of time and take a lot of work. It doesn't end just with one election.
Right. Right. So, I'm wondering, is there any chance your book is going to end up in those lovely bookstores that they have in the airports? Because that was where my friend went looking for it, and he was so disappointed he couldn't find it.
I don't think so, but you never know. I'm happy if it appears in other bookstores, Barnes & Noble, and other places where people can find it, both mm-hmm. Barnes & Noble. It's, you know, obviously it's online. People can purchase it, but I'm not expecting it to be in, you know, an airport yet, at least not on, I mean, it could be in some of those bookstores because some airports actually have much better bookstores these days. They're not just the kind of just, if you will, trashy novels and things
right.
that you just toss away after you've finished your flight.
Right.
I think that some of those airports have much better bookstores. I don't want to compare it to fantastic bookstore, but it's decent.
Yeah, I think one of the franchise like Hudson News or something like that, you know, yeah, I mean, you can actually get in there and find some decent stuff. And anyways, my friend would just love to see your book there. So he had three specific questions after reading
okay.
the entire book. Why don't we sort of plunk through
sure.
them a little bit?
Sure.
And the thing about these is that you are Jonathan Tessini, and you have a certain level of understanding of Bernie Sanders' history. You've written this great book that draws almost entirely upon his own words and, you know, and records and stuff. And yet I have read it, and so I can say it's not a dry read. It doesn't feel like, you know, you're just reading a bunch of quote after quote after quote. You know, you definitely are in there pulling it together smoothly. So these questions are directed to Bernie Sanders, and you're in the middle. So if you feel like you can't answer fully on Bernie's behalf, feel free to say that. But
okay.
Let's see. His first question, and this is how he worded it. Has anyone calculated how many wealthy individuals and corporations will leave the U.S. and take their jobs with them as the taxes are raised and loopholes are closed, and how many jobs would be impacted?
Well, that question has come up. I don't have in front of me the answer of the number, but that question comes up every single time that people talk about raising taxes. And the fact is that almost it does not happen that corporations leave because of higher taxes. And in fact, taxes tend to be, when you actually interview CEOs and they're not being asked ideological way, they're not being asked on a TV show, are you for or against taxes? Well, of course, taxes are bad. They're anti-competitive. That's what what they might say at first. But if you actually survey people in a very non-passionate way, if you survey CEOs, taxes actually does not rank high up on a concern of most CEOs. What ranks higher is, do they have a good educated workforce that they can pick from and recruit from in the area? How is the infrastructure? Are the roads good? And can they get good broadband? Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and taxes are an issue, but the level of taxation that we're talking about is not high. And part of the problem is it goes back to the point you made before, which is how do you get people to believe in these things? Well, we've had 30 years of this ideological campaign against taxes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the Eisenhower era, we had much, much higher taxes. No one thought twice about that. And no one would dispute that the 50s and then the 60s after that, post-Eisenhower, were the high point of the American dream, people buying homes, America growing. So taxes are not an issue. And conversely, what I would say is part of the problem we have is that because our taxes are so low, we continue to have a non-competitive economy. And infrastructure is the best example that I can give. China, which one would say is probably our biggest economic competitor, is building dozens and dozens of new airports all across China.
Right.
Huge infrastructure projects. And state-of-the-art airports, not like the sad John F. Kennedy Airport, which is just an embarrassment now and can barely function. And the reason they're doing it is they're investing a huge amount of money. Now, Bernie's proposing that we invest $1 trillion over the next 5 years, which actually is the amount that's being recommended by the American Society of Civil Engineers, because they say we have to put in, this is again, engineers saying this, not ideologues,
mm-hmm.
engineers saying we have to put $200 billion a year just to fix our infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
not upgrade it to a 21st century standard, but to get it to where we can say it now, back to where it can function. Forget trying to create an energy efficient infrastructure. And Bernie's saying it creates 13 million new jobs at high wages.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of a choice that you can make. You can say, oh, we're not going to pay taxes, or we're going to pay reasonable amount of taxes to upgrade the country, give good jobs, have a sustainable economy.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you're talking to an islander here, right? And so we've had all sorts of trouble with our ferries just recently. And there's a giant article in the local, you know, Seattle newspaper talking about the tremendous amount of money it's going to take to rebuild a new fleet to replace the aging fleet that's anything from, you know, some recent ones, but a lot of it's 40 to 60 years old boats, right? And then Boeing there was just some huge spread in my local island newspaper. I'm not quite sure why, but it was talking all about Boeing and answering questions and stuff. And Boeing is expanding their productivity into on the ground in China factories where they're going to do a lot of their finishing, because Boeing's competing with Airbus, of course, to try to sell all those planes to all the, you know, the Chinese who are building all these airports, right? And so, yeah, I mean, absolutely. Infrastructure is absolutely in our face. And yet if you're not thinking strategically or being aware of it, it'll just sort of like go over your head, and you won't realize that when Bernie Sanders is talking about infrastructure, he's talking about whether you can get to work. Those are actually interlinked issues.
That's correct. And we have to see that and understand that you can't look at taxes and economic development, all these things separate. They're all connected. They're a part of a puzzle. And the reason that to look at the second part of the question, which is why do companies go abroad? Well, they do that for two reasons. One is because they can stash trillions of dollars abroad and not pay a fair share of taxes. So that's about greed,
mm-hmm.
and paying their CEOs obscene amounts of money, and because they want to get slave labor wages in other, mm-hmm. countries. So it's a challenge to figure out how to manage a global economy that doesn't let CEOs exploit workers at slave wages.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that's an easy solution, but the answer is not to then force everybody in this country to accept lower wages and no health care, and allow them to get away with no taxes. That's not
right.
A solution. That's a never-ending cycle downward.
Right, yeah.
And I think the reason we're in this cycle is because we consistently elect the status quo. And Hillary Clinton will give you exactly more of that. And what we're suggesting, Bernie Sanders is suggesting, what I think this book shows, is that if you, it's not, as I said before, it's not going to happen overnight, but people have a choice. Do you want to have a political revolution that stops all these trends that make our life worse? Or do you want to go with the status quo? And, you know, people are going to decide that in an election.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah, it's always very interesting to me. I have, there's a woman, a very lovely woman, and she is very excited about the idea of potentially having a woman as president. And at the same time, she was a big proponent of 522. She and her wife and their son, they only eat organic food, and they want big pharma to stay out of their business when it comes to their medical choices. And I'm like, you do realize, you know, Hillary Clinton's law firm represented Monsanto, and she and her husband have been strong GMO advocates, and there's no way you're going to get that need met to be allowed to know in America what you're eating, like Europeans and Japanese don't know. You're not going to get that if you also have this particular woman as your president. I mean, for me, I'm hoping in 8 years to have Elizabeth Warren as president. But yeah, it's really interesting. If you don't track some of the details, you can end up voting completely against yourself. And we are used to the idea of really poor, undereducated, desperate people in small towns in the Midwest who vote against themselves because they're being tricked by, you know, the local political party, and they don't understand the issues. I don't usually expect someone who's highly educated, multiple degrees, you know, working a good job in a liberal, politically oriented community to also be voting against themselves because they're not paying attention to the issues.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree.
So let's go on to his second question, which this is definitely, we're talking, all three of these are hot topics. This is brilliant. Number two, what is his, and this would refer to Bernie Sanders, what is Bernie Sanders' exact stance on abortion? Is it allowable at any time for any reason? Is the baby a distinct individual with rights from conception only after birth or at a certain time of pregnancy?
He's entirely pro-choice, 100% yeah. Pro-choice.
Yeah. When I got these questions from my friend, I went ahead and said, hey, I'm going to throw from my experience as a Bernie Sanders supporter for a number of months now, I'm going to throw a couple ideas that I have out there, but then I'll still include them in the interview, right, with Jonathan Dessini. And on that one, for me, I made the point to my friend that there are multiple ways to reduce the number of abortions that occur, and that there's this really amazing TED Talk by, I believe it's Robert Wilkinson or something like that. If you go online to Google and you type in TED, which is all caps, T-E-D, talk, income, inequality, it will pull him up. And I think his last name's Wilkinson. And this guy and a number of other scientists were trying to find some consistent factor that would illustrate why, if you took the top 20 countries in the nation or in the world and you compared them, why do some of them have higher levels of social ills and some have lower levels? And so social ills would be literally mental illness, alcoholism, teen pregnancy, the number of people in prison, those types of things. And they were trying to find things in every issue, like was it the size of the country? Was it the tax level? Was it the, you know, what is it, right? Everything they pulled out, and they compare these 20 countries based upon that issue, there were always outliers, which meant that there might be some form of a consistency, maybe, but four or five of the countries would just be in completely weird places, and you'd go, okay, that's not a consistent factor to explain why we have more or less social ills from one country to the next. And then they stumbled upon income inequality. So that's the gap between the average rich and the average poor. And they ranked all of the state or the countries based upon Japan has the smallest income gap. The U.S. is second to highest, with Hong Kong, which is not actually a country, but it was listed. It's the highest income gap is Hong Kong, and then you have America below it. And it goes all the way down, you know, Switzerland's in there, Sweden, France, whatever, down to Japan. They found that absolutely every single marker of social health or lack of wellness that you could look at followed that chart with zero outliers exactly perfectly. It means that when you look at the gap, no matter what, if your country has a larger income gap than that country over there, you are going to have more social ills than that country has. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible. And so I made the point to my friend. I said, you know, I could see the need for abortion being reduced if a lot of the things that Bernie Sanders is working towards would happen, because they will decrease the income gap in this country, and they will increase the welfare of the people. They will improve people's lives. And the more desperate you are, the more likely you are to get pregnant unintentionally. And the less desperate and the more hope you have, the more focused you are on succeeding at your life, and you're less likely to get pregnant unexpectedly. So that was my response to that question.
Mm-hmm. That all makes sense to me.
Yeah. And I really hope people go to Google and check out that thingy. It's incredible. It's so awesome. All right. So the third question. Great, great question. What is Bernie Sanders' stance on gun control? What is the best way to keep guns out of the hands of criminals, mentally unstable people, and children?
Well, he's always been for banning assault weapons. His position has always been that what we need to do is eliminate guns that are solely devised to kill people. And we know what weapons those are. It's not a mystery to people. And he was always been for trying to expand background checks and eliminate loopholes at gun shows and things like that. And what he also points out, and one of the things I think is great about Bernie, is he sees things in context and in the whole piece. He also says you have to deal with the mental health system. So it's fine if you want to eliminate guns, but if you're also not addressing people and providing services to people who are mentally ill people who want to hurt other people will find ways of getting guns.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't just say, we're going to get rid of these guns, because if there are people who are ill, they're going to find ways of hurting other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so he always talks about that in that holistic way.
Right.
And at the same time, he talks about coming from a state that does not have local gun control laws. It's a state, Vermont, of people go out and hunt, and that he doesn't think that it's work to try to ban or threaten people or make people feel like hunters that they're not going to have access to their guns. And mm-hmm. So I think he's always tried to balance that in conversations with people about guns.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I have personally very much appreciated what I perceive as Bernie Sanders' sort of middle ground, common sense, balanced and holistic approach to the issue. For me personally, I have a very, very strong opinion towards personal responsibility. It's sort of like, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. But when I say that, I'm saying that from my own thoughts, not because of some rhetoric that I heard on a news thing, because it plays into lots of other things. I mean, marijuana does not ruin everybody's life. There's a lot of people who smoke pot and they're super successful and they're better off because they're using it medicinally or whatever. But then there's other people where it's a nightmare. So to me, anytime there is a candidate or a person who wants to represent the people and on an issue they take an extreme position, I don't trust that.
Yes, well, he's also had the experience, as I said, in his own state of how to deal with it and how to make sure people kind of have an ability to get their views heard. And, you know, you can look at it whether it's extreme or not extreme. I look at it as quite rational. Personally, I'm not a hunter, but I don't have a problem with people hunting if mm-hmm. they're going out and shooting deer. That's, you know, I would like them to be doing it for food's sake, but that's their choice. And I don't think it makes sense for people to be prevented from doing that.
Mm-hmm.
What we want to do is get rid of, Bernie has said, you want to get rid of what people know are the weapons that kill people. And those are, you know, Glocks and AK-47s and all these other crazy things that people have.
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously any gun can kill someone, but the ones that are, you know, the more rapid fire you are, it's sort of, you know, the mentally ill guy who went through Sandy Hook and caused so much horror and trauma and terribleness. You know, if he had walked in there with a single handgun, you know, it would have been a lot easier for the brave adults who attempted to take him down to have succeeded in doing that. you know. But yeah, you put military grade weapons into a civilian's hands in a country that doesn't necessarily require adequate training, adequate, you know, proof that you know what you're doing, can handle it, and can be trusted, and you're increasing the chances for serious risk. Yeah.
Yep, that's correct.
I'm going to take this moment to remind our listeners that you're currently tuned in to the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM KVSH. This is Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. My name is Marge Twisdale, program host and director, and I'm currently speaking with Jonathan Tessini, who has written The Essential, Bernie Sanders, and His Vision for America. So one of the ones on here, one of the chapters that is a little bit less obvious, or maybe it is obvious immediately, I don't know. One of them is media. Chapter 18, it talks about a neutral net and making sure all voices are heard. Personally, for me, I actually have a high value around the internet being as minimally micromanaged and controlled by the government as possible. Or I just know that concept of net neutrality really, really matters to me a lot, even though I don't understand it deeply. I'm curious if you could share a little bit about how Bernie Sanders has engaged with that issue.
He's been very vocal, actually, about the issue of net media concentration for a long, long time. And he's, you know, fought to try to keep the internet open. In particular, I think that it comes from him being an independent politician, a democratic socialist, a person that has had always struggled to get the traditional media to pay attention to him and to give his views voice. So he's been very, very, very active in the questions of media concentration and been very vocal about the dangers of Rupert Murdoch controlling media and other conglomerates. It's been one of his big issues.
Something like five mega corporations right now, I believe, absolutely dominate the corporate / mainstream media in America. Is that true? Is it down to five now?
I don't remember the exact number, but it's in that range. You know,
yeah.
It's Time Warner, it's Murdoch, it's a few Sony. It's a handful.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I've decided I don't talk about mainstream media anymore because I call it corporate media
or traditional media. Corporate media. That's, you know, whatever makes it clear to people that it's that kind of control of viewpoints in the hands of a few. So corporate media works for me.
Yeah. Let's see here. I definitely want to make sure that we get a chance to address the big S in the room. There's all these conversations going on out there about what's the difference between, I don't know, like a socialist Democrat or a democratic socialist or blah, 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 blah. So why don't you just go ahead and, for all of our listeners, just explain that one, since you are speaking more clearly from Bernie's perspective rather than these other people who want to tell us what Bernie thinks. Clarify that one for us.
Well, I think the easiest way of doing that is to simply say what he says. And when I first started to talk to him several years ago, he was convinced that his views were where the majority of Americans stood on issues. And so what he says is, I'm a democratic socialist. And immediately he says, I'm for expanding Social Security. I'm for breaking up the big banks. I'm for Medicare for all, single-payer health care. In other words, getting rid of the greed of the insurance companies, getting rid of those insurance companies, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes down the list. And that's him. That is a daily expression, a policy expression of what democratic socialism is. And it's a very American one. And it works for people. And people get really quite past it very quickly when you tell young people that Bernie Sanders, the democratic socialist, is for free college education so that people don't leave college with tens of thousands of dollars in debt. People immediately say, young people say, where can I sign up for that?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a mystery to people. So I think that one of the great things about this campaign is, I think at the end of the day, win or lose, the question of democratic socialism will not be an issue anymore. A year from now, 2 years from now, people will kind of shrug and say, oh yeah, I know what that stands for. It stands for the following.
Mm-hmm. So I'm not exactly, I've never been quite certain, Let me see. So there are people who have been taught to fear the word and the concept of socialism. And so that's that category of thoughts over there. And what we're dealing with right now with Bernie Sanders and his campaign is the concept of democratic socialism is a democratic society, representational democratic society, where, you know, the people speak and you have self-governance going on, but that the welfare, that the people...
Well, just think of it as Europe. You know, it's not, this isn't too complicated. It's anybody who's been to Western Europe, that's democratic socialism in many countries.
Right.
I mean, where there's a strong role for the state to play in providing social services to people, mm-hmm. because the private sector cannot do that, and that people have to pay reasonable amounts of taxes. You know, you go to Scandinavia, where democratic socialism has been in place for a long time, mm-hmm. or France, where people get, there's benefits, there's wage levels, there's retirement, there's health care. That's a manifestation of what democratic socialism is,
right.
where you're sharing the bounty and the wealth of a country through often high taxes, and people in Scandinavia and France and other places pay higher taxes, particularly Scandinavia. People don't complain in Scandinavia, really, because what they get is an incredible level of society and
right.
societal well-being. Our problem is that we have existed with a false idea of how you build a good society for many years. And so democratic socialism has been a victim of the Cold War and of the Red Scare and all this other stuff. And it's been posed versus the glories and the wonders of the free market. And the problem with that is that if you look at the last 30 or 40 years of that experiment, it's been a failure.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the growing divide between rich and poor, how wealth has been spread, it's not been equal.
Right. It was fine to suggest in the beginning, maybe even to believe that it was actually going to work out for everybody. But we do have to, at some point, assess the current situation, look back at the results of the experiment. I do encourage, I love the idea of looking back just over the last 100 years. Because, 125 years. Because in the late 1800s, you had certain elements of massive deregulation, and that led to the, quote, Roaring Twenties and the massive depression. And then we had, you know, this renewal of the social contract. We have, you know, the middle of the last century. We have the baby boomers. Everyone's getting, like you said, the middle class explodes. And then people are like, oh, we can start siphoning some of the wealth off of the middle class again, because look at, they're booming. And so there's all this, you know, take a little bit from people and they won't notice it, and we can become super wealthy. And the result now is right in front of our face, is we're basically living through what happened back, you know, 100 years ago. So it seems like the last 100 years gives us some really good experiment. And now, okay, what do we want to do going forward?
That's right.
You know, one of the things that I've noticed as a parent, and I live on Vashon Island, I own my house, my husband has a good job, we have excellent health care. We are definitely the comfortable middle class. We're not upper middle class, but we're not lower middle class either. Comfortable middle class. And yet, despite that, I've spent the last 17 years of my parenting career worrying about college, being very aware that if my husband lost his job, sure, we wouldn't have a paycheck, but even worse, we wouldn't have medical care. We wouldn't have the medical insurance, because he has really good, you know, corporate medical insurance is actually really awesome. And in, I always think what it must feel like when you live in a country where you're not worried about whether your kid can go to college, and you're not worried about what'll happen when, I mean, I know people who have kept their kids home when they think the kid broke, you know, his tailbone, but they can't afford the cost of going to the hospital. So we're just going to wait a few days and hope that everything's okay. Whereas with my family, we'd be like, oh, we're going to err on the side of safety. Let's go get you x-rayed. And the other family is like, no, we'll just stay home and hope it's okay, and only go in if it's really bad in a couple days. You know, I think there's a constancy to the anxiety, the dread, and the worry that Americans feel about these areas where if you don't do it on your own, no one cares if you go crashing down to the ground. And what a relief it would be to not have that nagging anxiety.
I agree with that.
So, okie doke, what would you like to finish with?
Oh, I think that we've covered most of what we probably need to cover.
Then we need to talk about how people can find you and this book. So,
well,
where's the best place to go looking?
The book is, you know, in bookstores everywhere, in independent mm-hmm. bookstores, which is always my favorite place to go.
And, right.
You have a great one in your area in Elliott Bay, which yep. is the Elliott Bay bookstore, which I've been to a number of times.
And you have books there. You know you have books there.
I'm almost certain. I would be surprised, and if there aren't, it's probably because they've sold them. And
right.
of course, people can ask and order it, but I'm pretty certain that there have been books, or probably, I haven't been to the bookstore, literally walked in there, but I'd be surprised if it wasn't there.
Well, we also have Vashon Bookshop. Excellent. Brilliant. I'm going to do what I can too. We have a farmer's market on the island, and we have a lovely book club that goes to the market and has a booth. And then we've got our local bookshop. So I will do what I can to try to bring some copies onto the island for people who...
That's fantastic.
Yes, would like to support the local businesses and don't want to walk off island because that can take time and money. And do you have anything else coming out soon or any? Do you have like a website where people can catch different articles you're writing at different times or?
Well, mostly I write about whatever I'm writing about on a regular basis at my website, workinglife.org.
Ooh, workinglife.org.
Yep.
Okay.
So it's where I tend to talk about things that I'm thinking about.
mm-hmm.
So that's where people can usually find out what I'm thinking about.
Yeah. I think, you know, this is the best thing about this book is it's the, you know, books are wonderful because they're the gift that keeps on giving. So, you know, you pick up something for yourself and it brings you information, knowledge, delight, whatever, joy, happiness. And then you pass the gift on, you pay it forward, and then they pass it on. And this book in particular, at a time where no one wants to find out later that they were confused on an issue and they voted in a way, you know, they voted against themselves. You know, you want to actually know what you're doing. And we have in our state of Washington, the Democratic Party does its own caucus system. So the Republican Party in the state of Washington depends upon tax dollars, which pay for the primary system. It's a government-funded electoral system, and the Republican Party runs its primaries through that system. But the Democratic Party does not take any tax dollars and they run a self-funded caucus system. And March 26th in 2016, obviously, March 26th is going to be our caucus here on the island. And between now and then, it's just really important for people to actually get the facts, just the facts, ma'am, you know, and ignore corporate media, I think, and go looking for what the candidates are actually saying for themselves.
That's great. Those forums are very important.
Thank you for writing this book.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for having me on, and look forward to the future.
Yeah, I know. Me too, exactly. All righty. Have a great day. Thank you.
Yeah, you too. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And that's our show, folks. Once again, you're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on KVSH 101.9 FM. This is Marge Twisdale, program host and producer. Thank you for tuning in and listening as my authors share how they hope to inspire positive change in our world, one reader and one listener at a time.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do. the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality, and until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify, and our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We'll not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many, you are the few.